Mr. Rhodes.
Well, thank you, Andrew and Mariah, for playing those pieces of music. Now, there weren't many people here today, so I think we're going to have to ask you to do it again when everybody's here. Okay? Have to see what we can do. And I've got to time this today because I'm only allowed 50 minutes at these World News and Prophecy seminars. I'm sure a lot of you will be already nodding off after 50 minutes anyway, so I'll get the sense that I've gone too long. Belshazzar was the last great... Can you cancel that on the recording? Belshazzar was the last monarch of ancient Babylon. A brief account of his end is provided in the book of Daniel, chapter 5. The chapter gives us some insight into the government of the world's superpower immediately prior to its fall, because the account in Daniel chapter 5 is of the night when Babylon fell. Babylon was the superpower of its day, and it was the first superpower recorded in Daniel chapter 7, which is the chapter on the great beasts that would dominate the world. And Babylon was the first of those, and the others certainly had great similarities with Babylon. Chapter 5 of Daniel is where we will begin. In verse 1, Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Now, here we see this great celebration taking place, and there was a desecration of these items brought from the temple, from the Jewish temple, and they were going to be used in this pagan ritual, which was a celebration of the gods of the Babylonians. Now, what's not revealed here in the book of Daniel is that by this time, already the city of Babylon was surrounded by hostile forces. The Persians had moved up all their troops around Babylon. But Belshazzar was absolutely confident that Babylon would not fall. This is, again, one of the great lessons of history, that often nations feel that they cannot possibly fall, but every nation contains within itself the seeds of its own destruction. And so did Babylon. So Belshazzar, by holding this celebration, was showing defiance against the Persians, that Babylon was secure. Babylon was noted for its thick walls, the walls around the capital city, which nobody else had been able to break through. But they did have a weakness, and Belshazzar was about to find out what that weakness was. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. By the way, the queen wasn't there. So his chief wife, the main wife, wasn't there, probably upset at the fact that all his other wives were there, who knows, but he had a lot of wives there. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. So this feast to all the pagan gods. Now the chief god of the Babylonians was the god Bel, hence the name Belshazzar. Shazzar actually meant fire. So, the implication is here that Bel, the god of fire, and, Belshazzar himself had this fiery quality about him. Remember, Daniel had his name changed when he was taken in captivity to Babylon. His name was changed to Belteshazzar, meaning Bel will protect you. And his Aramaic name was Belteshazzar, while his Hebrew name was Daniel. Shazzar then meant fire. And Bel was the chief god of the Babylonians. According to Xenophon, X-E-N-O-P-H-O-N, the ancient historian, Belshazzar was impious, I-M-P-I-O-U-S. Xenophon confirms Daniel's account of Belshazzar's end, which is recorded here in chapter 5. So here is a secular historical source which confirms what Daniel has written here. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary brings out that Daniel shows none of the sympathy for Belshazzar which he had for Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the first monarch that Daniel served under in Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar was a great king, although he certainly had his very serious problems. And Daniel often writes favorably of Nebuchadnezzar, all his great achievements, and the fact that the strength of the empire was in its head, the king himself, Nebuchadnezzar. But he shows no sympathy whatsoever for Belshazzar. And there are good, sound reasons for that. Quoting both Xenophon and Herodotus, who was a Roman historian around this time, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown recounts that Belshazzar killed one of his nobles merely because in hunting, the noble struck down the game before him. But even worse, he also, and I'm going to quote this rather than describe it myself, he unmanned a courtier, Gadatus, at a banquet because one of the king's concubines praised him as handsome. So right in front of them, he committed this despicable act. So Belshazzar really deserved what was coming. And you'll see as we go through this chapter exactly what was coming. In verse 5, in the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened, and his knees knocked against each other. Now, I'll leave you to interpret that verse yourself, but I think the way it's worded is very good. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The Chaldeans were the best educated people of Babylon. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck." Purple is a symbol of royalty. "And he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." The third ruler, because Belshazzar was actually the second ruler. His father, Nabonidus, was the emperor over the whole of the Persian empire, which now included Babylon. But when Babylon fell, when Babylon at this particular time, I'm getting mixed up here, his father Nabonidus was the ruler over the whole Babylonian Empire, not the Persian Empire. And his son, Belshazzar, was the ruler just of Babylon itself and the immediate area around it. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. Now all the king's wise men came in verse 8, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. You know, she hadn't been there at the beginning. The queen spoke, saying, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father," not literally your father, it was actually his grandfather. The phrase here just means ancestor in the Aramaic. And it's very similar to practice in West Africa. I mean, a lot of people in Ghana call me father. In fact, some of them call me daddy, when I'm obviously not. You can tell by immediately looking at them and looking at me that there's no direct physical connection. But it's just the custom. So, you know, Nebuchadnezzar is described as his father, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I've heard of you, that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. So Daniel wasn't impressed with his offers, and Daniel, you know, probably was aware of, you know, what was coming. O king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. You know, so Belshazzar was getting quite a witness here from Belshazzar, from Daniel, about the past and how Nebuchadnezzar was a great king, but the fact that he had the power he had came from God. And then, of course, Nebuchadnezzar, who became very vain, eventually was made like the beasts. He lost his mind. He had a mental problem for 7 years and acted like the wild animals. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of man and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son, in other words, he's saying until Nebuchadnezzar was humbled. And when Nebuchadnezzar was humbled, then he could be king again. And you have, but you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. So you didn't learn from Nebuchadnezzar's example. It's interesting, too. You know, he didn't even know who Daniel was, and yet Daniel had been prime minister under Nebuchadnezzar. So he obviously rejected Nebuchadnezzar's way of doing things and rejected the people at the court of Nebuchadnezzar. And you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lord, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. They're not real gods. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the inscription that was written. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upazin. These are monetary units of the Babylonian kingdom, different coins that they had. This is the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. It's probably the shortest-lived appointment of prime minister of anybody in history, because that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now notice here in verse 29, when Belshazzar proclaims him to be the prime minister, Daniel was restored to the same rank that he held under Nebuchadnezzar. He became the prime minister, the third ruler, as Belshazzar was co-regent with his father Nabonidus. Regarding verse 30, about the fall of Babylon, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown have this to say. Herodotus and Xenophon confirmed Daniel as to the suddenness of the event. Now remember, this was the United States of its day. This was the greatest power in the world, Babylon. The greatest empire in history until that time. And it fell, literally, in one night. And that is confirmed by Herodotus and Xenophon. So it's not, you know, it's not Daniel's account that we rely solely upon for the fall of Babylon. What happened was Cyrus, who was the king of the Persians, diverted the Euphrates into a new channel, and guided by two deserters, marched by the dry bed into the city while the Babylonians were carousing at this annual feast to the gods. So while this celebration was going on, and they thought that Babylon was invincible, Cyrus had his men divert the Euphrates River, probably over the course of 2 or 3 days. And then that dried up the river. The river went right through the center of Babylon. The river Euphrates is still there. You know, I mean, Iraq is used to be called Mesopotamia between the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. The Euphrates is still a major lifeline. And the river used to go right under the city. And so the only way you could really get in was, you know, underneath. So, you know, what Cyrus did was have the river diverted, and then the riverbed dried up sufficiently for all his troops to march in. And once they were in, they just slaughtered Belshazzar and everybody else, and Babylon fell to Persia on our wedding anniversary, October 12th, 539 BC. It wasn't the year we got married, though. Babylon was defeated by Persia. Now, look, you see that there's an example there of, you know, a form of government which is cruel and despotic and absolutely evil. Belshazzar deserved what he got. Daniel chapter 6 helps us see that the next leader also had his problems. And we can see things here which help us understand our world today, and I'll come to that towards the end of this particular sermon. But in Daniel chapter 6, we see the next king now, Darius. Now again, you had, we've already seen Cyrus mentioned, and Darius. Cyrus remained as the emperor over the whole Persian Empire, ruling from their capital. Darius was appointed the king of Babylon. So that's why you see Darius's name sometimes, and also why you see Cyrus's name sometimes, because Cyrus was the supreme ruler over the whole empire, which was now the Medo-Persian / Babylon empire. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. A satrap was an official position, one of the highest positions. And over these, three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. So the king appointed Daniel to a great position as well. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. He had more wisdom, gave better advice, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So he would have again been prime minister. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So Daniel clearly was noted for his religious convictions. So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, "King Darius, live forever. God save the king. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter." You know, this was Persia's biggest weakness, the law of the Medes and Persians. Total inflexibility in the governmental structure. And that was a major weakness, which I'm sure ultimately is what brought them down, because eventually they were taken over by Greece. You know, every nation contains within itself the seeds of its own destruction. And you see that clearly in all these different empires in ancient history, and even in nations today. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. So Daniel was not going to be intimidated by this. You know, this was his custom, to pray three times a day. And the fact that he opened his windows showed that, you know, he wasn't ashamed of worshiping God. And you know, that he was going to continue no matter what. Of course, we have to ask the question at this point, you know, why did this happen? I mean, why did, you know, why was such a decree issued? But we'll come to that. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. "Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions?" The king answered and said, "The thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter." So they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself, because he realized he had been tricked, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men approached the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it's the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. So the king was trapped. He couldn't change the law. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought before him. Also his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. You know, Daniel wasn't a threat to the king. Now the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he believed in his God. And then the king gave the command to have those who accused him thrown into the den of lions, including their wives and their children. You know, that is a common practice even in the Middle East and even Africa today. You know, if you have an opponent, you kill the whole family, because you don't want the children to grow up, you know, seeking revenge. So you have to kill everybody, including the youngest children, even including, you know, babies. Look at Daniel chapter 3, because we saw in Daniel 6, which is the Persian Empire of Darius and Cyrus, how religious freedom was easily taken away. In Daniel chapter 3, we also see how religious freedom was also easily taken away, this time under Nebuchadnezzar in the kingdom of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So they stood before the image at the end of verse 3 that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. So again, freedom of religion taken away. Everybody had to bow down to this image. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of all this music shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you set up. Daniel's not mentioned, probably because at this time he was above all this. He was the prime minister, perhaps right in the palace, and so he was not affected by this. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now if you're ready at the time you hear the sound of all the music to fall down and worship, then fine. But if not, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." So even if they were going to die, they were not going to compromise and bow down before this pagan image. Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and his expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these 3 men fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the 4th is like the Son of God." Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then they came out from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god. Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Just as an aside here, I should mention Nebuchadnezzar did not give up the Babylonian gods because he saw that the God of Israel was greater. You know, like many people who believe in lots of gods, a pantheon of gods, he just recognized that Israel had its God, and he felt they had their gods too. So he continued with his own gods as well. So what are the lessons that we can learn from these chapters? Well, my wife and I lived in the West African nation of Ghana at a time when freedom of religion was seriously threatened. In 1989, 2 prominent American-based church organizations were banned by decree, along with about a dozen others. In fact, one of the representatives of one of these churches came to our house this morning, trying to get us to accept copies of Awake and the Watchtower. And I told him I wasn't interested, but, you know, they were banned in Ghana, and so were the Mormons. They were banned, too. This followed a period of chaos that had gone on for some years. And I think an overview of those years will help you appreciate the way that government is in most of the world. There are insights in Daniel that help us even today to understand the rest of the world. Failure to understand the rest of the world is causing us to have so many problems in American foreign policy, the wars that we're fighting and losing at this present time. A lot of that is attributable to the fact that we have a blind spot when it comes to how different some nations are. And certainly these chapters that we've looked at in Daniel give an insight into dictatorship. And we've not lived in a dictatorship in the United States, not even in colonial times. You had checks and balances in colonial times. So America's never experienced that. Dictatorship is really, really frightening. And I was reminded of some of the things we went through in the first 5 years we had in Ghana. We had 7 years altogether, 5 years from 78 to 83. Then we went back in 88 for 2 years when things were a lot better. But in that first 5 years, you know, I was reminded of some of those things when my wife and I went recently to see the movie The Last King of Scotland. which is about President Idi Amin of Uganda. Uganda is not the same country as Ghana. It's a few countries over. But, you know, some of the things that happened in Uganda were very similar to things that also happened in Ghana. Now, I'm not going to endorse the movie. It's very violent, and there's some sexual content which is totally unnecessary in the movie. So I'm not saying I recommend it, but if you want to see it, it gives you a very good idea of what Africa is like at its worst. Now, Ghana right now is not like that. So if you have the opportunity to visit Ghana, I hope you take it. You know, countries kind of go through cycles. And Uganda was like this for a 7-year period under Idi Amin. And a lot of other countries in Africa went through very similar periods. And Ghana went through a period that was not as bad as Uganda's, but nevertheless, some of the things that are depicted in the film certainly took place in Ghana as well. And it gives an insight into the nature of dictatorship and how frightening it is. And I don't think we really appreciate that or understand it because we've never experienced it ourselves. We arrived in Ghana in May of 1978, and Ghana at that time had a military dictatorship, which was led by senior army officers under General Ignatius Achampong. 6 weeks after we arrived, there was a palace coup, which means intrigues in the presidential palace led to the removal of General Achampong, and instead Major General Fred Akufo became the leader of the Supreme Military Council reconstituted. And then a few months later we had a revolution led by junior officers in the Air Force. And after this revolution, all the previous presidents were arrested. They were all taken out to a firing range, tied to stakes, and shot publicly. All the previous presidents. And this set the tone for the period of rule by the man who took over, a man called Jerry John Rawlings, J.J. Rawlings. In 1981, after a brief period of democratic government, there was another coup. And for what followed that was 2 years of successive attempted coups. And you know, I got caught up in one of those, and it was a really frightening thing. Just driving along the road in my car, I had my assistant with me, and we were coming back from Spokesman's Club, and suddenly everything in front of us was black. There were no cars at all, and we were surrounded. The car was surrounded. All these guns were pointing at us, and the guy was sitting next to me. You know, a gun was right in his face from his side. A gun was right in my face. And they were about to shoot us. And suddenly this voice shouted out from nowhere, "Wait, stop." And this was obviously their commanding officer. And the commanding officer said, "Check first." He said, "See if they are CIA. And, you know, I'm going, not CIA, missionary. I hate the word missionary, but under these circumstances, I was quite happy to use it. I said, missionary. And they said, CIA. And they just wanted to shoot us. And Then Steve, the guy who was with me, said, "Mel," he said, show them your Bible." And, you know, I thought, I don't want to show them my Bible. They'll take it, you know, and it had all my notes in it. But I guess that wasn't important at that particular point. So I said, okay, I'll get out and get my Bible. So, you know, I get out, and again, they search me, you know, give me the, you know, patting me down outside of the car and make me go to the trunk of the car and open the trunk of the car. And I pulled out my briefcase and showed them a Bible. But, you know, basically what it came down to was the commanding officer was arguing with these other two soldiers, telling them not to shoot us, and they wanted to shoot us. And I thought, you know, you stand there thinking, they're discussing whether to kill us or not. This is unreal, you know. And, you know, finally they let us go. And, you know, when I left, I remember I got my foot on the gas pedal, and I was shaking so much I couldn't even keep it on the gas pedal. And then, you know, finally we took a circuitous route back to the house, because we were trying to avoid any more roadblocks. And we finally got back to the house. Of course, as soon as Diane opens the door, she says, "Where have you been? You're late for dinner." So, often the wrong thing is said. But it turned out it was an attempted coup. And on another occasion, I mean, we took our children to school every morning, and around 10 o'clock in the morning, a car pulled up from the British High Commission, the British Embassy, and a lady got out, and she had our children in the back seat, and we thought, what's happened? Soldiers had landed in the school playground, jumped out of the helicopters, randomly firing as they got out of the helicopters in the school playground. And so, you know, the embassy had got all the kids out and brought them home. So, you know, these are the kind of things that happened and went on for a considerable period of time. So we had 2 years of successive attempted overthrows of the government, famine. We had a total collapse of the economy. Now, Ghana's revolution inspired another revolution in Liberia, which was another country I pastored. So here were two countries I pastored, and both had a revolution more or less the same time. Ghana's was in June, and I think Liberia's was the following April, so less than a year later. And Liberia, which was a really nice country before the revolution, changed literally overnight again. And it was an even more bloody revolution. And all the members of the cabinet that they could find were taken out on the beach, tied to stakes and shot after despicable things were done to them. Now what is interesting is the response of the people. Look at Daniel chapter 3. And this is where, you know, we need to understand the way that thinking is different in other countries. That not everybody is trying to be an American or trying to be like us. Look at Daniel chapter 3. After Nebuchadnezzar's decree that all people should worship this image, in verse 7, so at that time when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp and lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You know, that is really disturbing when you think about it. The people's response was to do what they were told to do. Now, I think if the President of the United States ordered everybody to bow down before an image, you know, most people would turn around and tell him what he could do. You know, and that's the same, it would be exactly the same in England. The British people would not tolerate that either. However, that is not the way it is in most countries. People go along with whatever their leader says. You see that clearly in the movie, The Last King of Scotland, because when Idi Amin overthrows the government, everybody's out in the streets celebrating, like Idi Amin is the great savior of the people. When J.J. Rawlings took over Ghana in the revolution of June 4th, 1979, everybody was celebrating. J.J., Jerry, John, they said J.J. stood for Junior Jesus. He was the deliverer of the people, a Messiah who had come to save them. It was the same in Liberia when Samuel Doe took over in their revolution in April of 1980. And yet, you know, when you live long enough, you see the end result of it all. A few years later, Samuel Doe was overthrown. And he had done to him in the streets of Monrovia, the capital, what Belshazzar had done to Gadatus. The same thing was done to Samuel Doe, right in front of hundreds or thousands of people. And, you know, this is the way some countries are. Look at Daniel chapter 6, verses 12 and 13. They went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. You know, here is the plot against Daniel. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you've signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day. What does this tell us? Everybody else simply went along with it. They just went along with it. So when the decree was issued, you cannot pray to your own God, didn't bother people. Okay, well, for a month we'll just bow down and, you know, we'll just petition the king. Bow down to him instead of the true God. Well, it's frightening. But that's exactly what it's like living in countries, in certain cultures where there's a tradition of dictatorship and, you know, people just go along with everything. So in Ghana, everybody was celebrated when J.J. Rawlings took over. At the airport last year, when I got off my plane from Amsterdam, KLM, I saw J.J. Rawlings again. My wife and I have seen him once in a restaurant, and we stayed as far away from him as we possibly could, and that was while he was in power. And then in Ghana, I saw him again last year, and it was kind of interesting because he has a secretary, another man, who accompanies him everywhere, and the man was getting the bags, and Rawlings was standing completely by himself. He's no longer in power anymore. But nobody went up to him and spoke to him. You see, the fear is still there, the fear that existed back in 1979. But back in 1979, he had popular support for his revolutionary ideas. But of course now, the reality had become, people had become more aware of the reality, that it became a dictatorship. A bloody dictatorship. People were tortured, just the same way as you see in the movie The Last King of Scotland about Idi Amin of Uganda. And, so people were staying away from him now. Matthew chapter 20 contains a passage where Jesus Christ, points out some of these things in Matthew chapter 20, beginning in verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he asked her, "What do you wish?" She said, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom." Now these were Israelites, but, they wanted power for themselves. It's a human tendency. But Jesus answered and said, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" They said to him, "We are able." He said to them, "You will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with, but to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them." You look at different translations of this verse, and they convey a sense of never-ending power struggles. People wanting to take over and have power, which is pretty much the way it is in most of the world. In Africa, in the Middle East, even in some Asian countries, and even in South American countries, where there has been this tradition of dictatorship. You have these power struggles. People wanting to take over from others. So you don't have a form of constitutional government. You know, the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. And when the leader takes over, then, of course, he takes great joy in just humiliating people and lording it over people. We saw the contrast when we lived in Rhodesia. Rhodesia was ruled for a while. The prime minister was of British descent, Ian Smith. And then the country became Zimbabwe. And the new leader, President Mugabe, has been in power ever since, for 27 years, and is a ruthless dictator. But Ian Smith, when he came to our small town to speak, arrived in a police car with a policeman with him, and I believe there was another vehicle accompanying them, if I remember correctly. When Robert Mugabe would come, there were at least 200 vehicles, helicopters, armored cars, police on motorbikes, making everybody get out the way as his car came through the city. This lording it over people and thinking he's really great, and of course taking lots of titles for himself as well. Now these are the words of Jesus Christ, showing incredible perception of the Gentile governments of his day, the kind of governments that Daniel lived under in both Babylon and Persia, the kind of government we saw in modern Babylon, Iraq, which is where Babylon used to be. This is the kind of government Iraq had until a few years ago. So I think the question is, will the United States be able to implant its own political system there or anywhere else where they've had a bloody, tyrannical dictatorship? Well, our experience in Africa helped us see why democracy doesn't work and can't work in most countries. One reason is tribalism. People think in tribal terms. In 2001, after a 10-year absence, I returned to Ghana. And I went to Kumasi, where the church office is, and at dinner with the ministers one evening, they asked me about our previous experience in Ghana, and I mentioned some of the problems that we had lived through. And all the ministers in Ghana are younger than me, at least all the pastors are. So, you know, they listened to some of the experiences we had had. And then they started to talk about how different things are now and how wonderful the president is now and what a great man he is and all the things he's done for Ghana. And as they talked, I had a thought cross my mind. The new president must be an Ashanti, because they were all Ashantis, all except one of the pastors at the dinner table were Ashantis. And they wouldn't say the president was good unless he was an Ashanti. And then they talked about the president who was in power when we were there, and he was all bad because he was an Ewe. See, not the policies, but the identity is with the tribe. Tribalism is very important even today in Africa. In fact, people identify more with their tribe than they do with their country. And, you know, that's one reason why democracy doesn't work. Another reason is because of religion. Now, that's not a major issue in West Africa, except in Nigeria, where you've got a big Muslim population. But in Iraq, you've got this incredible division of Sunnis and Shia, and they hate each other. You know, there was an interview on PBS with a Somalian lady whose name I've left in my briefcase. Her last name is her first name is Ayan, and then something Ali, and she's written a book called Infidel. And she's an interesting person. You'll remember a few years ago, in fact 2004, Theo van Gogh was murdered in Holland. He was killed because he had made a short documentary exposing how Muslim men treat their women. And he was slaughtered on the streets of Amsterdam. Well, this lady had actually helped him make the documentary. She had come from Somalia, which is a Muslim country. And she actually became a member of the Dutch Parliament and then was forced out of Holland and now lives somewhere in the Washington area and I think helps one of the governmental think tanks on the Islamic world. But she was very interesting in this interview. She said, most Americans make the mistake of equating Islam and Christianity. So the thinking in the United States is that because in Congress in the United States, we have Catholics, we have Protestants from all these different denominations, and they all work together, and religion is not an issue that divides them in itself, so we think that the Sunnis and the Shia can do exactly the same. And maybe even Christians and Jews can live in those countries too, and can all work together. And she said, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. She said, Islam never had a reformation. Islam never had an enlightenment. You cannot question anything in Islam. She has rejected Islam, as a result of which her family members would like to kill her. So she has 24/7 police protection in the Washington, D.C. area somewhere. She said that in the interview. She said, I always have bodyguards with me. She said, Theo van Gogh's problem was that he didn't have a bodyguard with him, and so he was slaughtered on the streets. You cannot leave the religion of Islam. Those of you who read the Lansing State Journal will remember a letter about a year ago from a Muslim here in Lansing, a woman who wrote in and said that you know, she was quite proud of the fact, you cannot leave Islam. If you do, we will kill you. This was a letter in the Lansing State Journal. So it doesn't change just because people move, you know, to the United States. And this lady spelled that out very clearly. Unfortunately, the interview was after midnight. When who's watching it? Who's going to take any notice, you see? You know, so again, you get back to Daniel, you see the thinking that is still the way of thinking in so many parts of the world. The thinking is different in the United States because we evolved differently. You know, the U.S. came out of England, where government evolved over centuries. Even 1,000 years ago, the Saxon kings of England were chosen by the Witan, a council of nobles. The first parliament in England met in 1265. Gradually, they evolved a democratic system based on checks and balances. All England's colonies, except for Hong Kong, including all the colonies here in the Americas, were democracies. People voted. Men voted. 90% of the men in colonial Virginia voted before 1776. So there was a long democratic tradition. Democracy was deeply embedded in the culture. So was religious freedom. Voltaire, the French philosopher in the 18th century, commented on England and the English colonies in America in 1770. He made the comment that if there was only one religion, it would be despotic. If there were two, there'd be a never-ending civil war. But fortunately, there's 30 different church denominations, and they've all had to learn to get along with each other. You see how our society evolved completely differently from some of these other countries. Other countries have not had that same cultural development in their history. Does the tribal or religious identity extent in the Third World end when people move to the West? There was a conference this week in Los Angeles on gangs. Political correctness doesn't allow the police from the various countries that attended this conference to state the obvious. There's a major problem in Los Angeles with gangs. The people who come from El Salvador form one gang. Those who come from Guatemala form another gang. Those who come from various African countries form other gangs. The Koreans have their gang. The Vietnamese have their gang, and so on. You know, why do they form these gangs? Well, of course, officially at the conference, it's all due to socioeconomic factors. If we have more money, then we'll solve the problem. But, of course, the reality is that people from tribal cultures identify with the tribe. So when they go to a country that is strange to them, they naturally want to be together to reform, reconstitute the tribe. And so these gangs really are just the tribes that come from other parts of the world. Now, the purpose of this lecture was to help you all understand that most of the world thinks very differently from the way that we do in the West, that the thinking and the forms of government resemble more the ancient empires of Babylon and Persia, and are aptly described by the words of Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 20. Hopefully you can now understand and appreciate more fully the way the world is, and why the United States is having so little success in attempting to bring the American political system to the rest of the world. 51 minutes. I'll have to cut something out before next Sabbath. Anyway, I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Well, hopefully I'll see some of you at Fitch's house tonight. And it's nice to see you all again.